The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
A cutthroat quest for buried treasure begs the question, is one life really more sacred than another? H.G. Wells, today on the Classic Tales podcast. Welcome to the Classic Tales podcast. Thank you for listening. We are proudly supported by our listeners. We couldn't do this without you. Your monthly donation helps in so many ways, and it also gives you access to more classic titles. Go to ClassicTalesAudiobooks.com and become a financial supporter today. A $5 monthly donation gets you an $8 monthly coupon code for any audiobook order. Thank you so much. Herbert George Wells lived from 1866 to 1946 and saw the world change on a scale like never before. A forward-thinking social critic, he wrote a number of utopian works and foresaw the advent of aircraft, space travel, nuclear weapons, and the World Wide Web. He was known for placing commonplace detail alongside a single extraordinary assumption in each work. This method was dubbed Wells' Law. His most notable works include The Invisible Man, The Time Machine, The Island of Dr. Moreau, and The War of the Worlds. Today's story contains the commonplace details surrounding a hunt for buried treasure. What do you see as the single extraordinary assumption? And now, The Treasure in the Forest by H.G. Wells. The canoe was now approaching the land. The bay opened out, and a gap in the white surf of the reef marked where the little river ran out to the sea. The thicker and deeper green of the virgin forest showed its course down the distant hill slope. The forest here came close to the beach. Far beyond, dim and almost cloud-like in texture, rose the mountains, like suddenly frozen waves. The sea was still, save for an almost imperceptible swell. The sky blazed. The man with the carved paddle stopped.
"It should be somewhere here," he said.
He shipped the paddle and held his arms out straight before him. The other man had been in the forepart of the canoe, closely scrutinizing the land. He had a sheet of yellow paper on his knee.
"Come and look at this, Evans," he said.
Both men spoke in low tones, and their lips were hard and dry. The man called Evans came swaying along the canoe until he could look over his companion's shoulder. The paper had the appearance of a rough map. By much folding, it was creased and worn to the pitch of separation, and the second man held the discolored fragments together where they had parted. On it one could dimly make out, in almost obliterated pencil, the outline of the bay. "Here," said Evans, "is the reef, and here is the gap." He ran his thumbnail over the chart.
"This curved and twisting line is a river. I could do with a drink now, and this star is a place."
"You see this dotted line?" said the man with the map. "It is a straight line, and runs from the opening of the reef to a clump of palm trees. The star comes just where it cuts the river. We must mark the place as we go into the lagoon."
"It's queer," said Evans after a pause, "what these little marks down here are for. It looks like the plan of a house or something. But what all these little dashes, pointing this way and that, may mean, I can't get a notion. And what's the writing?"
"Chinese," said the man with the map.
"Of course he was a Chini," said Evans.
"They all were," said the man with the map. They both sat for some minutes, staring at the land,
while the canoe drifted slowly. Then Evans looked towards the paddle.
"Your turn with the paddle now, Hooker," said he.
And his companion quietly folded up his map, put it in his pocket, passed Evans carefully, and began to paddle. His movements were languid, like those of a man whose strength was nearly exhausted. Evans sat with his eyes half closed, watching the frothy breakwater of the coral creep nearer and nearer. The sky was like a furnace, for the sun was near the zenith. Though they were so near the treasure, he did not feel the exultation he had anticipated. The intense excitement of the struggle for the plan, and the long night voyage from the mainland, in the unprovisioned canoe, had, to use his own expression, taken it out of him. He tried to arouse himself by directing his mind to the ingots the Chinaman had spoken of, but it would not rest there. It came back headlong to the thought of sweet water rippling in the river, and to the almost unendurable dryness of his lips and throat. The rhythmic wash of the sea upon the reef was becoming audible now, and it had a pleasant sound in his ears. The water washed along the side of the canoe, and the paddle dripped between each stroke. Presently he began to doze. He was still dimly conscious of the island, but a queer dream texture interwove with his sensations. Once again it was the night when he and Hooker had hit upon the Chinaman's secret. He saw the moonlit trees, the little fire burning, and the black figures of the three Chinamen, silvered on one side by moonlight, and on the other glowing from the firelight, and heard them talking together in pidgin English, for they had come from different provinces. Hooker had caught the drift of their talk first, and had motioned to him to listen. Fragments of the conversation were inaudible and fragments incomprehensible. A Spanish galleon from the Philippines, hopelessly aground, and its treasure, buried against the day of return, lay in the background of the story. A shipwrecked crew, thinned by disease, a quarrel or so, and the needs of discipline, and at last taking to their boats never to be heard of again. Then Shang He, only a year since, wandering ashore, had happened upon the ingots hidden for 200 years, had deserted his junk, and reburied them with infinite toil, single-handed, but very safe. He laid great stress on the safety. It was a secret of his. Now he wanted help to return and exhume them. Presently the little map fluttered and the voices sank. A fine story for two stranded British wastrels to hear. Evans' dream shifted to the moment when he had Chang He's pigtail in his hand. The life of a Chinaman is scarcely sacred like a European's. The cunning little face of Chang He, first keen and furious like a startled snake, and then fearful, treacherous and pitiful, became overwhelmingly prominent in the dream. At the end, Chang He had grinned, a most incomprehensible and startling grin. Abruptly things became very unpleasant, as they will do at times in dreams. Chang He gibbered and threatened him. He saw in his dream heaps and heaps of gold, and Chang He intervening and struggling to hold him back from it. He took Chang He by the pigtail, how big the yellow brute was, and how he struggled and grinned. He kept growing bigger, too. Then the bright heaps of gold turned to a roaring furnace, and a vast devil, surprisingly like Chang He, but with a huge black tail, began to feed him with coals. They burnt his mouth horribly. Another devil was shouting his name. "Evans! Evans, you sleepy fool!" Or was it Hooker? He woke up. They were in the mouth of the lagoon. "There are the three palm trees. It must be in a line with that clump of bushes," said his companion. "Mark that. If we go to those bushes and then strike into the bush in a straight line from here, we shall come to it when we come to the stream." They could see now where the mouth of the stream opened out. At the sight of it, Evans revived.
"Hurry up, man," he said, "or by heaven I shall have to drink sea water."
He gnawed his hand and stared at the gleam of silver among the rocks and green tangle. Presently he turned almost fiercely upon Hooker. "Give me the paddle," he said. So they reached the river mouth. A little way up, Hooker took some water in the hollow of his hand, tasted it, and spat it out. A little further, he tried again. "This will do," he said, and they began drinking eagerly. "Curse this," said Evans suddenly. "It's too slow." And leaning dangerously over the fore part of the canoe, he began to suck up the water with his lips. Presently they made an end of drinking, and running the canoe into a little creek, were about to land among the thick growth that overhung the water.
"We shall have to scramble through this to the beach to find our bushes and get the line to the place," said Evans. "We had better paddle round," said Hooker.
So they pushed out again into the river and paddled back down it to the sea, and along the shore to the place where the clump of bushes grew. Here they landed, pulled the light canoe far up the beach, and then went up towards the edge of the jungle until they could see the opening of the reef and the bushes in a straight line. Evans had taken a native implement out of the canoe. It was L-shaped, and the transverse piece was armed with polished stone. Hooker carried the paddle.
"It is straight down in this direction," said he. "We must push through this till we strike the stream. Then we must prospect."
They pushed through a close tangle of reeds, broad fronds, and young trees, and at first it was toilsome going. But very speedily the trees became larger, and the ground beneath them opened out. The blaze of sunlight was replaced by insensible degrees by cool shadow. The trees became at last vast pillars that rose up to a canopy of greenery far overhead. Dim white flowers hung from their stems, and ropey creepers swung from tree to tree. The shadow deepened. On the ground, blotched fungi and a red-brown incrustation became frequent. Evans shivered.
"It seems almost cold here after the blaze outside."
"I hope we are keeping to the straight," said Hooker. Presently they saw, far ahead, a gap in the somber darkness where white shafts of hot sunlight smote into the forest. There also was brilliant green undergrowth and coloured flowers. Then they heard the rush of water. "Here is the river. We should be close to it now," said Hooker. The vegetation was thick by the river bank. Great plants, as yet unnamed, grew among the roots of the big trees, and spread rosettes of huge green fans towards the strip of sky. Many flowers and a creeper with shiny foliage clung to the exposed stems. On the water of the broad, quiet pool, which the treasure-seekers now overlooked, there floated big oval leaves and a waxen, pinkish-white flower, not unlike a water-lily. Further, as the river bent away from them, the water suddenly frothed and became noisy in a rapid.
"Well," said Evans.
"We have swerved a little from the straight," said Hooker. "That was to be expected." He turned and looked into the dim, cool shadows of the silent forest behind them.
"If we beat a little way up and down the stream, we should come to something." "You said," began Evans.
"He said there was a heap of stones," said Hooker. The two men looked at each other for a moment.
"Let us try a little downstream first," said Evans.
They advanced slowly, looking curiously about them. Suddenly Evans stopped.
"What the devil's that?"
he said. Hooker followed his finger. "Something blue," he said. It had come into view as they topped a gentle swell of the ground. Then he began to distinguish what it was. He advanced suddenly, with hasty steps, until the body that belonged to the limp hand and arm had become visible. His grip tightened on the implement he carried. The thing was the figure of a Chinaman, lying on his face. The abandon of the pose was unmistakable. The two men drew closer together, staring silently at this ominous dead body. It lay in a clear space among the trees. Nearby was a spade after the Chinese pattern, and further off lay a scattered heap of stones, close to a freshly dug hole. "Someone has been here before," said Hooker, clearing his throat. Then Evans suddenly began to swear and rave and stamp upon the ground. Hooker turned white but said nothing. He advanced towards the prostrate body. He saw the neck was puffed and purple, and the hands and ankles swollen. "Pah," he said, and suddenly turned away and went towards the excavation. He gave a cry of surprise. He shouted to Evans, who was following him slowly. "You fool! It's all right! It's here still!" Then he turned again and looked at the dead Chinaman, and then again at the hole. Evans hurried to the hole. Already half exposed by the ill-fated wretch beside them, lay a number of dull yellow bars. He bent down in the hole, and clearing off the soil with his bare hands, hastily pulled one of the heavy masses out. As he did so, a little thorn pricked his hand. He pulled the delicate spike out with his fingers and lifted the ingot. "Only gold or lead could weigh like this," he said exultantly. Hooker was still looking at the dead Chinaman. He was puzzled. "He stole a march on his friends," he said at last. "He came here alone, and some poisonous snake has killed him. I wonder how he found the place." Evans stood with the ingot in his hands. What did a dead Chinaman signify? "We shall have to take this stuff to the mainland piecemeal and bury it there for a while. How shall we get it to the canoe?" He took his jacket off and spread it on the ground and flung two or three ingots into it. Presently he found that another little thorn had punctured his skin. "This is as much as we can carry," said he. Then suddenly, with a queer rush of irritation, "What are you staring at?" Hooker turned to him. "I can't stand him." He nodded towards the corpse. "It's so like rubbish," said Evans. "All Chinamen are alike." Hooker looked into his face. "I'm going to bury that anyhow before I lend a hand with this stuff." "Don't be a fool, Hooker," said Evans. "Let that mass of corruption bide." Hooker hesitated, and then his eye went carefully over the brown soil about them. "It scares me somehow," he said. "The thing is," said Evans, "what to do with these ingots? Shall we rebury them over here, or take them across the strait in the canoe?" Hooker thought. His puzzled gaze wandered among the tall tree trunks and up into the remote, sunlit scenery overhead. He shivered again as his eye rested upon the blue figure of the Chinaman. He stared searchingly among the grey depths between the trees. "What's come to you, Hooker?" said Evans. "Have you lost your wits?" "Let's get the gold out of this place anyhow," said Hooker. He took the ends of the collar of the coat in his hands, and Evans took the opposite corners, and they lifted the mass. "Which way?" said Evans. "To the canoe?" "It's queer," said Evans, when they had advanced only a few steps. "But my arms ache still with that paddling." "Curse it," he said, "but they ache. I must rest." They let the coat down. Evans' face was white, and little drops of sweat stood out upon his forehead. "It's stuffy, somehow, in this forest." Then, with an abrupt transition to unreasonable anger, "What is the good of waiting here all day? Lend a hand, I say. You have done nothing but moon since we saw the dead Chinaman." Hooker was looking steadfastly at his companion's face. He helped raise the coat bearing the ingots, and they went forward perhaps 100 yards in silence. Evans began to breathe heavily. "Can't you speak?" he said. "What's the matter with you?" said Hooker. Evans stumbled, and then with a sudden curse, flung the coat from him. He stood for a moment, staring at Hooker, and then with a groan clutched at his own throat. "Don't come near me," he said, and went and leant against a tree. Then, in a steadier voice, "I'll be better in a minute." Presently his grip upon the trunk loosened, and he slipped slowly down the stem of the tree until he was a crumpled heap at its foot. His hands were clenched convulsively. His face became distorted with pain. Hooker approached him.
"Don't touch me! Don't touch me!"
said Evans in a stifled voice.
"Put the gold back on the coat."
"Can't I do anything for you?" said Hooker.
"Put the gold back on the coat."
As Hooker handled the ingots, he felt a little prick on the ball of his thumb. He looked at his hand and saw a slender thorn perhaps 2 inches in length. Evans gave an inarticulate cry and rolled over. Hooker's jaw dropped. He stared at the thorn for a moment with dilated eyes. Then he looked at Evans, who was now crumpled together on the ground, his back bending and straightening spasmodically. Then he looked through the pillars of the trees and network of creeper stems to where, in the dim grey shadow, the blue-clad body of the Chinaman was still indistinctly visible. He thought of the little dashes in the corner of the plan, and in a moment he understood.
"God help me," he said.
For the thorns were similar to those the Dyaks poison and use in their blowing tubes. He understood now what Chang He's assurance of the safety of his treasure meant. He understood that grin now.
"Evans!" he cried.
But Evans was silent and motionless, save for a horrible spasmodic twitching of his limbs. A profound silence brooded over the forest. Then Hooker began to suck furiously at the little pink spot on the ball of his thumb, sucking for dear life. Presently, he felt a strange, aching pain in his arms and shoulders, and his fingers seemed difficult to bend. Then he knew that sucking was no good. Abruptly, he stopped, and sitting down by the pile of ingots, and resting his chin upon his hands and his elbows upon his knees, stared at the distorted but still quivering body of his companion. Chang He's grin came into his mind again. The dull pain spread towards his throat and grew slowly in intensity. Far above him, a faint breeze stirred the greenery, and the white petals of some unknown flower came floating down through the gloom. This is BJ Harrison. I hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Treasure in the Forest by H.G. Wells. If you have enjoyed this book, please become a monthly supporter by going to ClassicTalesAudiobooks.com. Donate $5 a month and get a monthly coupon code for $8 off any audiobook order. It's a great way to build out your library of classic literature. Thanks for pitching in. Thank you for joining me today and allowing classic literature to awaken your better self. Please join me every week and we'll rediscover the greatest stories ever put to paper.
When you make decisions for your company, you always look for the no-brainers. And if you have a lot of mailing and shipping to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. It streamlines your process to make your business more efficient, which makes you less busy. Mail checks, invoices, legal documents, books, and everything you need to keep your business running with Stamps.com. Seamlessly connect with every major marketplace and shopping cart if you sell online. Schedule package pickups through the dashboard and automatically see your cheapest and fastest shipping options from different carriers, with rates up to 89% off USPS and UPS rates. And with the Stamps.com mobile app, you can take care of mailing and shipping wherever you are, even on the go. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other business decision makers with Stamps.com. Sign up at Stamps.com with code PROGRAM for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, plus free postage, and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
If you're in business, you probably have a website, but can your site handle your growth? How many visitors before your site slows down or crashes? What about storage and data security? From web hosting to virtual servers, Pear Networks provides the online infrastructure you need to start, grow, and flourish. When it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 U.S.-based customer support is the best in the industry. No frustrating chatbots or sitting on hold for hours. Check out pear.com today to learn more. That's P-A-I-R.com.